are two primary reasons that I wanted to do this series. The purpose of the series is kind of twofold. One, I wanted us to really catch a glimpse of the aggressive nature of God's grace. And what I've said from day one in this series, that grace is more than just God being lenient with us. And grace is more than just God's unmerited favor, which is often the definition that we hear of grace, and it's a good definition. But we believe that even that definition falls a little short. It's undeserved, it's unearned, it's unmerited. But what is missing from that definition is the aggressiveness of God's grace. That God's grace goes after us, and it comes after us, and it's relentless, and it pursues us. And so this series has been a reminder of God's aggressive pursuit in the name of grace. And then the second purpose of this series, and one that I really want to focus in on today, the second purpose of this series is to remind us and help us understand our vast, desperate need for God's grace. I think number one is kind of natural. I think the first purpose to see God's aggressive grace, I think that's kind of natural to see it. As we kind of traverse through the redemption story of the Bible, we've seen it. I mean, we've seen Adam and Eve when they sinned against God and lived in deliberate disobedience and then hid themselves in the bushes wearing their pathetic leaves because of their sin, that God comes down into the garden and seeks them out and pursues them. And the very first question of the Bible is a grace question. Where are you? And he seeks them out. We see it as we walk through the biblical text and as we've walked through this series. We saw it in a man at that time named Abram, who would become Abraham, as he enters into this covenant with this holy God. And we talked about the blood covenant of that day, the ritual of that day of dividing animals in half, and the two parties would walk between the animals to signify the significance of the covenant. And we saw the unilateral nature of the covenant as God puts Abraham to sleep. The animals are divided in half, and God walks alone through the animal. And the blood splashes up on his robe and his sandals as he walks alone, signifying that we're incapable of upholding our end of the bargain. And that's what grace is. It's God walking alone in the covenant. And then we saw it in the Judah story. I mean, wow. A story so R-rated that we question if we should even read it out loud. I mean, it's not in our children's books for sure. It's not the one you're going to pop open the little cartoon characters at home. Hey, honey, before you go to sleep tonight, let me tell you about Judah. I mean, I didn't even read part of the text. A story so R-rated, and yet God's grace is seen in the Judah story as he shows up in the craziest place of all, the genealogy of Jesus. And then we saw it in the story of Moses and the Israelites as God delivers them out of 400 plus years of bondage and slavery, and as he leads them through the desert, and as Moses goes up to get the Ten Commandments, the children of Israel in the mountain below, after Moses has been gone a couple of hours, like, I'm not sure this guy's coming back. I've got a great idea. Let's go back to Egypt. Let's create a golden calf that we can put our hands on and feel and touch. I mean, the whole parting of the Red Sea thing was awesome. The whole deliverance from 400 years of bondage and slavery was great. The 12 plagues really showed the power of God. But in this moment, I sure would like to bow down to a cow because I can see it and feel it. And yet God sets up shop among his wayward people. He dwells in a tent that we call the tabernacle. We said on that Sunday that it was as if God had been joined to the Israelites in a spiritual ceremony of covenantal marriage, and on the wedding night they went out and committed spiritual adultery, and God still comes down and shows his grace. We see it as we walk through the text and see the aggressive nature of God, and then we saw it our last time together when we were in the Kara series in the story of Rahab, who happened to have a nickname, who happened to have a label. Rahab the harlot, 8 times she's mentioned in Scripture. 6 out of those 8, this label is attached to her. Rahab the harlot, the Canaanite, she lied to get the spies into her house and to set them free. And then she said, look, just one deal. When you guys conquer the city of Jericho, can I be a part of the redeemed people? And God's grace is poured out on a Canaanite harlot. And then when she shows up in Matthew 1, she shows up in Hebrews chapter 11 as we see God's grace being poured out. And so I think we get, number one, we get God's aggressive grace and how it pursues and goes after. And these stories and hundreds of others in the Bible remind us of the determined nature of God's incomprehensible and sometimes outright offensive grace. Grace happens in the brokenness, in the sin, in the evil. I'm not so sure we completely grasp number two. I'm not so sure that we really understand our vast need and dependence on this same grace. And here's why. It's what I do and it's what you do. The reason is that we tend to categorize our sin, don't we? Like, I'm not as bad as this person. I'm not as bad as that neighbor. I'm not as bad as this person at work. You won't believe what this person did. I'm not as bad as you fill in the blank. I'm not as bad and sinful as that person. And if you don't believe that's true, just go on your social media feed and read about the presidential candidates. Just go read. Spend 30 minutes listening to the news. Spend 30 minutes reading Facebook about our existing presidential candidates. That we all have this kind of superiority attitude of, well, I'm not as bad as him. I'm not as bad as her. I didn't say this. I didn't do that. And our not-so-bad sins pale in comparison to our candidates, our friends, our coworkers, the guy down the street, the person who abused me, the man who left me. Our not so bad sins pale in comparison to everyone else's sins. And we kind of live with this us versus them superiority, that the news about me and my sin doesn't seem as bad when I compare it to them and their sins. My sins don't seem so bad when I read about this or him or her, or when I hear this story or this person bragging about this night or this chapter in their life. My sins don't seem quite as desperate as that person. Netflix recently released a documentary about Amanda Knox, who is the accused and then acquitted killer of a friend. You remember it was all over the news. And at the end of the Netflix documentary, Amanda Knox makes this statement. People want the reassurance that they know who the bad people are and that it's not us. People want the reassurance that they know who the bad people are and that it's not them, that it's not us, that it's not me. And it makes us all afraid that it is. Interesting perspective. You see, I tend to hinge my identity on who I am better than. I tend to hinge my identity as a Jesus follower on someone else's sins. Well, I'm not as bad as that person. I tend to hinge my identity on comparing, and it clouds our understanding, one, of how sinful we really are and were, and how much we need grace. This us versus them superiority causes us to fail to really grasp how desperately I need God's grace, how sinful I am. And Charis reminds us, my sin, as small as I may, as I try to make it, as much as I try to trivialize it, my sin requires the same divine grace as you fill in the blank. My sin requires the same grace as the Donald Trumps of the world, the Hillary Clintons of the world, the neighbor down the street, the abuser, the pedophile, the killer, the murderer, the blasphemer, the atheist, the agnostic. My sin requires the same divine grace as that person that comes to your mind. Same grace. And so what we've said as we've read these new Old Testament stories, we've been finding grace in the Old Testament. The warning that we have given as we've gone through this is don't read the Bible looking for moral examples. Don't read the Bible thinking that the characters we find there are the people that we should emulate. That the intention of the Bible is to be like whoever. Be like David. Be like Saul. Be like Gideon. Be like Joshua. That's not the intention of the Bible. The Bible is God's story. It's His story. It's God making history, His story. It's a story of a God who pursues rebels amidst the ugliness. Let me give you some examples as we kind of continue to move through the Old Testament story. We find grace in a book like the book of Judges. Let me summarize Judges for you in just a few verses from the book of Judges. Judges chapter 4, verse 1, "And the people of Israel again did what was evil in sight of the Lord after Ehud died." So the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Chapter 6 of Judges, verse 6, "And Israel was brought very low because of Midian." They were being oppressed by Midian. Watch what happens. "And the people of Israel," what? "Cried out for help to the Lord. And when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord on account of the Midianites, the Lord sent a prophet to the people of Israel. And he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage.'" Again and again and again in the book of Judges is this cyclical story that Israel falls into idolatry. They disobey. They rebel against God, and God punishes them through oppression, the oppression of other nations, of neighboring countries. They are oppressed. They are made slaves. They are oppressed by other nations. And what do? They cry out to God for help. And what does God do? God sends a deliverer. He sends a judge. That's the name of the book. He sends a judge again and again and again. They fall into sin. They fall into idolatry. They bend their knee to the golden calf. They want to live back in Egypt. They go into bondage again in slavery. God sends oppressors. He sends people to judge them. He sends instruments. They cry out for help. God delivers. God forgives. What do? They fall back into sin. You know what? As a matter of fact, it sounds a lot like my story. Pursue God, fall into sin, cry out for help and forgiveness. God heals and forgives. Everything's great until it's time to bend the knee to the golden calf again. Our story is very similar. Our journey is very similar. And that's why the book of Judges is filled with grace stories. Now, if you think the Bible is boring, read the book of Judges. Let's be honest, it reads like a Quentin Tarantino movie. I mean, as a matter of fact, I thought maybe there were some Quentin Tarantino titles that we could assign to the book of Judges. Inglorious Judges. Reservoir Jews. You got to be a Tarantino fan to get some of these. Samson Unchained. And we don't even have to change the name of this Tarantino movie. Natural Born Killers, right? I mean, You read the book of Judges, it's brutal and it's violent. Let me give you some examples. Ehud, judge. Southpaw assassin. Sneaks into the chambers of a king and buries his dagger into this obese king to the point that the obesity of the king, the fat of the king, literally swallows up the dagger. And by the way, he does this while the guy's sitting on the toilet. Sneaks out the back window. Ehud, the left-handed judge. Deborah, first female judge. She's a female judge that God uses because the men are cowards and they refuse to step up. And so she steps up and she leads an insurrection against the rebels that were holding them. That ends, the story ends with the enemy king being slain by another female who lures him into her tent and drives a spike through his head while he sleeps in her tent. Gideon. I always love the story of Gideon. God calls him, brings out 10,000 or 30,000 people. He says, that's too many. Trim it down to 10,000. Take them down to the stream. We still got too many. Whoever drinks like a dog, that's the people. 300 guys left, 300 soldiers fighting hundreds of thousands. God uses them to win an incredible victory without ever even drawing the sword. We love the story of Gideon. Read the story of Gideon. Read it. Gideon was basically a bipolar Baal worshiper. On one hand, he was a fearful coward. At other times, he was a vengeful, arrogant jerk. He had incredible faith moments, like the ones that we highlight in our children's stories book. He had incredible moments where he tore down the idols and threatened those who would dare to rebuild it. And then shortly thereafter, he led the people back into idolatry. That's Gideon. After Gideon, two sons of Gideon took over. Talking about a legacy. Abimelech, his first son, had three of the most violent years recorded in the book of Judges before having his own head crushed by a millstone by another female. His second son, Jephthah, was the son of a prostitute. And he makes an irrational bargain with God that if Israel prevails in war, that he will sacrifice the very first thing he sees when he returns home. Here's the problem. First thing he sees when he returns home, his beautiful teenage virgin daughter who runs out to greet daddy after war. And he has to take the life of his own kid because he made a foolish bargain with God like he's some type of genie in a bottle. Samson, gotta love that story. The Navy SEAL of Judges, right? I mean, Navy SEAL on steroids. Only problem with Samson? Disobedient sex addict. He was obtuse, he was selfish, he was proud, and he uses his final moment on life to seek revenge instead of pleading for God's mercy. We love the story of Ruth that happened at the same time as the book of Judges, but rest assured, Ruth was no Disney princess. She was a Moabite, non-Israelite, who oils herself up and lays at the feet of a man to win his heart for her own purposes. Not good advice to give your teenage daughters. These are the people that God uses to keep the redemption story going until finally we reach this statement in the book of Judges that there were no judges in Israel. There was no one to rule them. And things got even worse. And the stories in that part of the book are so brutal and evil and depraved that we cannot talk about them with kids in the room. And story after story speaks of one thing. No sin, no one can outrun, can out-sin the grace of God. He writes his story of grace and redemption in the brokenness and depravity. Listen to this truth that is hard for me to wrap my mind around sometimes. God even works evil for his glory and for our good. God even works in sin and evil and depravity and brokenness. He works and writes his story in the brokenness, in the depravity, in the ugliness. Now, make no mistake, God never celebrates sin. God never applauds sin. God never rewards sin. Sin is a direct front on a holy God. It is a direct violation of everything that he is. And sin has deep and lasting consequences. It is destructive, it is deadly, and we are fools to chase after it. And these stories that I'm talking about, they put on full display the devastating consequences of sin. And don't you be fooled for one second into thinking it's okay to pursue that path, because that's how big God's grace is, because it will devastate and ruin and destroy your life. But is God's grace that big? Absolutely. You can't outrun it. You can't out-sin it. You can't outperform it. Sin is not bigger than God. Sin does not limit God. Sin does not frustrate God. Sin does not thwart God's redemptive plans and purposes. Sin does not stop God's redemptive plan in history. Sin does not stop God's redemptive plan in my life. And when we get that, when we understand the vastness of sin and the vastness of grace, when we grasp it, it rewrites our lives. Our lives become defined not by our sin, but by his grace. We see, we need it. We need grace. We need it as much as these Bible characters that I have described. We need it as much as your neighbor. We need it as much as your coworker, your family member, your ex-spouse, that person you despise. We need it because we are all sinners. Even the most righteous among us needs grace. Remember David? And we love the stories of David, don't we? Matter of fact, when I say David, what do you think of when I say David? David and who? Goliath. I mean, that's what we remember. David and Goliath. Shepherd boy fights a giant. Five smooth stones. And around 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 and around. Remember that little David story? Only a boy named David. Only a little sing. Only a boy named David, but he could play and sing. Wow. We love the story of David and Goliath. We remember the David and Goliath story. But guess what? That's not the whole David story. That's not what defined David's life. Let me tell you about David. Before Goliath, pre-Goliath, David, he was a musician who was responsible for, hold on to your pants, sheep. He was a boy who lived in the field playing his harp, whose primary goal in life was to make sure the sheep stayed in the pasture. Man, that's a recipe for getting beat up at PE at school. That was David, pre-Goliath, a musician. Nothing wrong with musicians. But if any of our musicians decide they're going to move into a field and start watching over sheep, you're going to leave me scratching my head, I can tell you. But that's pre-Goliath David. And God sends this prophet Samuel to anoint a new king, by the way, because of the brokenness of the current king, the current psycho king of Israel, Saul. And that's a whole story of grace and redemption in and of itself. But when Saul's brokenness finally gives way, God sends Samuel to the house of Jesse to anoint a new king. The prophet gets there and says, "Bring out your boys. One of them is going to be the king of Israel." And so Jesse lines his boys up, oldest and strongest to youngest, except one. he lines his boys up, and I love this part of the story, 1 Samuel 16, 6 and 7. This is from the perspective of Samuel the prophet, the one that's been assigned the anointing. When they came, Samuel, he looked on Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Like, check this guy out. This is him. If we need a king, this is the guy. He's big, he's strong, he's handsome, he's a leader. This has got to be the guy. But the Lord said to Samuel in verse 7, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Samuel says, God, this guy makes sense. This guy makes sense. And if you know the story, it's not Eliab. And Samuel moves on to the second son. Well, if it's not him, surely it's this guy. Well, he's not Eliab, but look, this has got to be the guy. And God's like, it's not him. And on down through the line until they've come to the last son. And God says, it's not him. And Samuel's confused. Well, you said one of the sons of Jesse. We've gone through all the sons. And he turns to Jesse and says, got any more kids? Like, is this everyone? Jesse says, oh, I got another one. I didn't even bother to bring him. I mean, he's playing a harp in the field watching the sheep. I'm not sure he's going to be the warrior king that Israel needs. And Samuel says, bring him. And we know the story. That's God's chosen one. Wrong family? Not in the family of Saul, the king. Wrong birth order? He's the runt. They even bring him to the draft. Wrong appearance? Wrong training. God's chosen. Grace in the story of David. And then we all love the story of David facing Goliath. We talk about grace. Number one, the fact that God used a teenager, grace. I'm just kidding. We love our teens. I got three of them. Grace and a teenager with a slingshot. And you gotta love the story, right? It's not what we make it. It's not overcoming odds and things like that. But the story in itself is an awesome story. I love David's words to the mighty warrior, Goliath, that says he was trained from the time he was a boy to be a warrior, and they pulled David in from the field. Verse 45, David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day, who? The Lord. Whose battle was it? It's God's. It's grace. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. I love the trash talking of David in this text. Zach and I were in an environment last Sunday where there was a lot of trash talking. I sat quietly with my hands folded, joking. We had some fun entertaining trash talking ourselves. We were playing our arch rival, and it's fun to get caught up in the environment and yell things at the other team and other fans who pull for that team. A lot of fun times. Heard a lot of trash talking. No trash talking compared to David standing before a trained warrior and saying, dude, I'm going to cut your head off. And it's not going to be because of how awesome I am. It's going to be because of how big God is. Can you imagine how Goliath felt that moment? I mean, who are you? I mean, I can thump you and kill you. And yet, Goliath wasn't in control. David wasn't in control. God was in control. It was grace in a teenage boy with a slingshot. Love the David and Goliath story. But it's not a story about David. It's a story about the God that picked David out of the field and stood him before the enemy so that all the world would know how big God is and how powerful God is. And if we're being honest, this is one of the highlights of David's entire life. It gets very messy from here. And it's why we don't take the David and Goliath story and try to moralize it somehow and talk about slaying your giants and overcoming and if you throw the right rocks and you're going to defeat your giants. That's not what the story is about. We're not David. We're the brothers hiding in the tent afraid. Jesus is David. We're not David. David can't even defeat his own giants in his life. Read his story. This is not a story about somehow overcoming your giants. This is a story about Jesus does what we can't do. Jesus has already defeated the giant. He's already defeated death, hell, and the grave. We stand in his victory. We make a mistake to try to moralize the story of David and Goliath and say, be like David. Don't be like David. Do you read the story of David? I mean, isn't this most evident in the story of David and Bathsheba? The story of David and Bathsheba is not just about an affair. David covets a friend's wife. He should have been in battle. Instead, he's at home looking where he shouldn't have looked, and he sees a beautiful woman inappropriately attired, and he covets after her. He lusts after her. He has sex with his friend's wife, a person in this authority, with this power. We could basically label this rape. Whether she willingly did it or not, who's going to say no to King David? He brings her in and he has sex with a friend's wife, and then he lies to his friend. He lies to him and brings him off the battlefield and gets him drunk to try and cover up his own sin. And it doesn't even work. So what does he do? He basically writes a death warrant for his own friend and sends him back into the battlefield. One of his noble men, one of his warriors, one of his guys that was fighting for him to defend his freedom and his kingship and his authority, sends him back with his own death warrant. He basically kills his own friend. This is not just a 50 Shades of Grey affair. And then what happens? He has the opportunity to confess or conceal. And he chooses to conceal until he gets caught. His sin finds him out. Can I be really honest with you right now? I don't know anyone personally as sinful as David is in this story. I don't know anyone. I'm not hanging out with anyone as sinful as David is in this story. I mean, 5 out of the 10 commandments he breaks in one episode. And not the small ones. Not the like disobedient to parents. They're all big, but you know what I'm saying. We probably don't have people in our lives as sinful as David is in this moment. Let me tell you David's legacy. He lost his kids. He faced God's judgment repeatedly. David, in his noble intention, says, God, I want to build you a house. I know the whole tabernacle thing was cool, but I want to build you a temple. Like I want people to know who you are. I want to build you a house that represents that. And you know what God says? You can't because you're too violent. You shed too much blood. Your son will build it, but David, you can't build it. You've got too much blood on your hands. His kingdom was divided. His own son conspired against him. Most of his life was a wreck. And yet, he's described as a man after God's own heart. There's no one in the Old Testament that tested God's grace more than David. And here's what he reminds us. Grace has no limits. Here's what David reminds me. I need Jesus. I need him. I need Jesus. And the story of David screams to me, Devin, you need Jesus. Don't put your eyes on David. Don't put your eyes on these Bible characters. Don't put your eyes on who's doing what and who's righteous and unrighteous and I'm better than him or compared to him or my sin's not as bad. Devin, you need Jesus. And David reminds all of us this morning, we need Jesus. Jesus did what David could not. Jesus is the moral example that David was not. Jesus resisted temptation when David could not. Jesus was innocent when David was guilty. Jesus said no when David did not say no to temptation. Jesus went to the battlefield when David stayed home. We need Jesus. David is not the hero. Jesus is the hero. Now, we're facing a crucial time, aren't we? Like this week. But here's what you have to know. And I hope that you hear me preach and speak enough to know this. It doesn't matter what happens on Tuesday. Neither person is the hero. Neither person determines our hope and fate and our future. Our kingdom is not of this world. Be wise. Use guidance. Vote if that's your conviction. Follow your conscience if that's your conviction. That's what freedom in Jesus is. But at the end of the day, we don't put our hope and faith in any human. Can you imagine the TV ads that would be run if David was running for president? Are you kidding me? I mean, you think what we see now is bad? We don't put our eyes on those around us. We don't put our eyes and our hope and our faith in the broken people of this world. We're wise and we live in this world, as we talked about it, as exiles. We live like 1 Peter instructs us to live. But at the end of the day, Jesus is the hero of our story. Our faith and hope is in him and him alone. Guess what? No matter what happens in the election on Tuesday, I've already been elected by the King of Kings. Second Samuel 7. I'm going to read you a few texts and we're out. Listen to God's promise to David. We read the promise to Abraham. This is David's covenant with God. The covenant that God gives to David. The entire chapter of 7, if you have time later to read it, is the covenant. I just want to zone in on just a few verses. 2 Samuel 7:11. From the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, so we saw the judges. From the time I appointed judges over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. This is God to David. This warrior, this blood shedder, this soldier that was responsible for taking a lot of lives, God says, look, there's going to be peace. I'm going to give you rest from your enemies. The Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. You hear what I just said 5 minutes ago? God said, David said to God, I want to make you a house. And God said, you got too much blood on your hands, but guess what, David? I'm going to establish your house. What? Unilateral grace. One-way grace. I'll make you a house. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring. God says, I'm going to raise up your son after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. This is the God of gods, the King of kings, speaking to sinful humans, to David of all people. And verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. If you read about David's kids, they didn't turn out that well. As I mentioned, his own son tried to conspire against him and take the kingdom out from under him. And God says to David, where you have failed as a father, I will step in. I'll be a father to your kids. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But, 15, my steadfast love. The original word here that's translated two words into our English Bibles, the original word is one word. Here it is. Listen to it. Similar to what we've been talking about. Charis is the Greek word for God's grace. The Hebrew word here is the word chesed. Hear it? My chesed, my steadfast, unconditional, pursuing, aggressive grace, my steadfast love will not depart from him. So I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. God's promise to David is one-sided, unilateral. God says to David, I will pour out my love on you. Chesed love, steadfast love, covenant love, grace. You don't deserve it. You've killed. You're an adulterer. You're a cheater. You are a murderer. You have blood on your hands. But I won't give up on you. I will pursue you and establish your kingdom. One of our favorite verses or chapters in all the Bible is Psalm 23, right? Let me show you something in Psalm 23 that you might miss. This is the words of David, of course, one of his most beautiful psalms. And we see just the up and down of David's spiritual life all throughout the psalms. But he pens Psalm 23, which is one of the most beautiful psalms in all of the book. And we love the words of the psalm. They're often read to provide comfort and at funerals in different places. But what does David write? He writes, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. In other words, God is everything I need. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. This is the words of a shepherd. So he understands the depth of what he's writing. He restores my soul. There's that word, redemption, restoration. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Did David ever experience that? I mean, the intensity of the life that he lived with every corner of his world being pursued by enemies and facing death all the time. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, David says, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. There's the chesed love of God. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. And then here it is, verse 6. Surely goodness and, same word, chesed, steadfast, unwavering, aggressive, divine, love, mercy, grace, surely, goodness, and charis shall follow me all the days of my life. You know what this word follow means? It means to hunt down. Think Discovery Channel. Think predator. Think lion going after prey. Hunt down. Your mercy, grace, steadfast, unconditional, offensive, unearned, undeserved, grace will hunt me down. You ever been in a place of life where you needed God to hunt you down because you had run so far and so fast and so far away? And he hunted you down. You ever been in a place where you tried to outrun God? Outsin God? And he hunted you down? His mercy and his grace pursued. I tell people, God pursued me when I didn't want to be pursued. I didn't want to be pursued. I wanted to run. I wanted to be far away. I wanted to do my own thing. And yet, he hunted me down. He didn't give up. Goodness and mercy will follow me. They will hunt me down. How long? All the days of my life. One more and we're done. We've been here. Let's go back. Matthew 1. Matthew's laying it out. This is who Jesus is. This is his lineage. This is his bloodline. I'm proving Jesus is the Messiah, is Matthew's goal in his gospel. Verse 6. This is as he's listing the genealogy. And Jesse, the father of David, the king. And David was the father of Solomon, here it is, by, not Bathsheba, that's the mother here, by who? By the wife of Uriah. He's not hiding it, editing it out, changing the storyline. Matthew says, let me tell you who David was. Yes, he was the king. He was the king that represented the King of Kings. But don't forget, in the David saga, in the David story, his son Solomon was the product of a wicked, wicked episode. The wife of Uriah. He highlights the messiness again to remind us of the grace. Here's what I want you to take away. God's grace is bigger than you can even begin to imagine. It's bigger than you think. God's grace is bigger than what you can wrap your mind around. It's bigger than you think it is. It's bigger than you realize. Here's the other takeaway. Your sin is bigger than you realize. You need it. You need his grace more than you realize today. His grace is bigger than you realize. Your sin is bigger than you realize. You need his grace more than you recognize, more than you realize. So what do? We run to it. What is your darkest, deepest secret? What is your deepest sin? What is your most difficult struggle? It's more sinful than you realize. But guess what? His grace is bigger than you realize. What is your finest moment? What is your puff out my chest, throw my shoulders back, I made the right decision, I made the best choice? What is your finest moment in life? Guess what? You need his grace more than you realize in that moment too. In your most righteous moments and your most unrighteous moments, you desperately need his grace more than you realize. And in both, in our righteousness, our self-righteousness, and in our unrighteousness, we need his grace. We need it. We rest in it. We live from it. Because when we run, it's what pursues us. Surely, goodness and charis, grace, chesed, steadfast love will hunt me down all the days of my life.